This is Digital Story Podcast number 827, January 25th, 2022. Today's theme is The Forgotten Magic of Fill Flash. I'm Derek Story. Our smartphones and many of our digital cameras have built-in flash capability. And to some degree, when to use this feature is counterintuitive. As a result, millions of pictures that could be improved with Fill Flash never receive that beneficial burst of light. Hopefully that's going to change after today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. There's nothing new about Fill Flash, right? It's a technique that's been popular way back in the film days. And I say that way back in the film days, like, you know, they were dinosaurs or something, but it has been a while now. And it was particularly useful with film because film had a more limited dynamic range. And if you were shooting candid portraits or just candids of people in general outside, you know, under normal lighting conditions, you never really knew what the light was going to do, if it was really high above or if it's to the side or whatever. And a lot of times it might look good for the background, but not so good for the person you're taking a picture of. And this is where Fill Flash was so handy, especially when you're doing on-the-move portraits, such as at a wedding. With Fill Flash, what it does is it brings in that very flattering front light from the camera, and then the camera balances that exposure with the ambient lighting, you know, the surrounding light of the environment, to make this really pleasing photograph where the subject looks good and the background looks good. So it's particularly handy when you're taking pictures of people in harsh sunlight. It's just not good because harsh sunlight is not good for people. It really isn't, especially like during the summer where the light's coming down from the top and their eye sockets get dark and their nose casts a shadow and you can see all the wrinkles and all that kind of stuff. No good, no good at all. Fill Flash can really help with that, can really help make the person look so much nicer in the photograph. Now, the thing about working with Fill Flash, I think, is that it's counterintuitive for some folks, right? Because generally speaking, it's opposite of what you think you would use flash for. So when the light is bright, you're taking pictures of people outdoors, you turn on the flash. As the light goes down, let's say like at twilight, then you turn off the flash, right? Because then you want to use existing light photography, because a big burst of flash in a kind of a darkened environment really makes these sort of unflattering pictures. They just look weird, and subjects sometimes get kind of ghostly looking, you know, all the stuff. We've seen those photos. I don't have to describe them anymore. So the idea of having to turn on the flash when it's bright out and turn it off when the light gets low, well, for some folks, that just doesn't make sense. But that's exactly how you use it. Now, I don't think that we see as much fill flash these days because our digital cameras are so good at recovering highlights and opening up shadows. So you can just snap away even in terrible lighting and you go, you know what? I could probably fix that in post. I could probably make it look better. And chances are you could. But here's the thing. If you don't have to do post-production on it, why do it, especially for a bunch of candid shots? If it's a birthday party, an anniversary, a family gathering, a wedding, you know, all that kind of stuff where you may have a lot of shots, do you really want to go through and have to adjust each shot? Or do you want to just capture it right out of the camera, whether it's a digital camera or your smartphone or a film camera, and then not have to worry about it, not have to do anything? Well, I like that path better, and that's one of the reasons why I think Fill Flash is so useful, because it's a huge time saver, and it really does make the pictures look pretty. What is the principle behind this? Why does this work? Well, here's the thing, that a lot of times when you're outside, let's say it's a summer birthday party, the light's kind of coming down from this top angle, it's bright, you know, usually clear day, all that. And it's just harsh. It makes harsh shadows. You don't know exactly how it's going to be shining on a person's face. And the old rule of that lighting coming from the side increases texture and lighting coming from the front softens texture. Well, that really applies to portraits, right? So if the light's coming from the side and that's the only light that you have, ooh, okay, you can do the math on that one. However, if you let that light do its thing, light up the background, light up, you know, stuff, and then you bring in a light from the front that you know is flattering for portraits, and then the camera goes, oh, I know what you're doing because you gave me the instruction, which I'm going to talk about in a second, then it just magically balances those two lighting situations into a pleasing portrait. That's how this works. That's how this works. So that light coming from the front is for the person. All the rest of the light is for everything else in the shot. Remember, side lighting increases texture, front lighting softens it. Alrighty. Now, the interesting thing is that our smartphones and our digital cameras that have a built-in flash unit, they can do fill flash, but they're turned off or they're not enabled. Fill flash isn't enabled. And the reason why I say that is that the default mode for most cameras and smartphones for the flash, if they have one, is auto. Now, auto flash works in a very logical way, which means that when there's lots of light, auto flash doesn't flash, right? It's going, there's lots of light. We don't need any light here. We don't need any additional light. I'm not going to flash. And then when the lighting goes down, if you have it on auto light, and it can't render the scene, then that flash will come on because it needs more light. Well, what you have to do is take your built-in flash off auto, and when you want to use the fill flash technique, you take it from auto to on. In other words, you force the flash on. So you're telling the camera, every time I take a picture, while this setting is set this way, I want that flash to go off, okay? Forced fill flash. Alrighty. Now you get that balancing act because once you tell the camera or the smartphone to do that, it will take care of everything else. It will try to give the right amount of light on the subject. Now, some smartphones and some cameras do that better than others, but that's what it's going to try to do. And it's going to try to balance that light with the lighting in the overall scene. And it makes a very flattering portrait. And these are just candids, right? So how do you do this? Well, on the iPhone, for example, a modern iPhone, you go to the camera app, and then up at the top of the interface, if you're holding the camera vertically, for example, there's this arrow, or it's an angled thing, right? It looks like an arrow pointing up. It's just two lines. And you tap on that at the top of the interface, and it reveals camera settings down below. So you top this thing up here, and then it reveals camera settings. The flash control will be on the far left on an iPhone. So you see that little flash control once you reveal the camera settings, and you tap on it, and you get three choices. You get auto, which is the default setting. You get on, and you get off. Well, you know, on and off are the two that I use almost all the time. I rarely have my flash set on auto. I know when I want that flash on and I know when I want that flash off, and I'm not going to let the camera or the smartphone decide for me. So when you want to use fill flash, let's say that, you want to bring a little light in from the front, then you tap on. Okay. And now you're telling the smartphone every time you take a picture, you're telling the iPhone every time you take a picture, I want that little wimpy LED light to, you know, put a little front-facing light in. And that's the problem with smartphones. You see, this is where our digital cameras, I think, are so much better because they have more powerful flashes. They tend to have, you know, strobe lights built in there instead of little LEDs. Because the whole idea of using fill flash is when you're out in bright conditions, you want to soften those shadows. You want to soften those textures by bringing light in from the front. But that light has to be able to stand up to the ambient lighting that's all around. those little LEDs have a problem. And sometimes you have to get so close with these LEDs and you still don't see a difference. This is when I think having a digital camera is so much better. Almost all of my fill flash shots are done either with my Fujifilm X100V or the Olympus EM10. Because the Olympus EM10, regardless of which version you have, 1, 2, 3, or 4, it has that little pop-up flash that's so handy. I just love digital cameras that have built-in flashes. Now, you can use a hot shoe flash for this, right? If you want to carry a hot shoe flash around and you don't need, you know, a big elaborate flash setting to use this outdoors for candid portraits. You just need that little burst of light coming from the camera that has some oomph to it, like the EM10 can provide, like the X100V can provide, like a lot of digital cameras can provide. So you turn that flash on, whether it's on the digital camera or the smartphone, knowing that it's going to work better, far better on the digital camera in bright conditions than your smartphone. Now on the X100V, I have some additional options. So I can turn it on to TTL, which is through the lens metering, which is, you know, probably the best way to go for using any sort of flash exposure. I have manual output, which means I can set the flash to, you know, 1/4 or 1/2 or full power. TTL determines how much flash on the fly. And that's why it's so cool, because you don't have to figure it out. It just does it. But there might be times when you want to control the flash. So it has a manual mode for 1/4, 1/2, and full. And then it has this very wonderful thing called flash exposure compensation. Now, this is just for the flash, and it allows you to increase the flash based on what the meter is saying for TTL, or decrease the flash. Almost always for fill flash portraits, you're going to decrease the flash a little bit, because that's what makes a very natural looking outdoor candid portrait. Now, I just leave mine set on -1/3 EV, but sometimes, depending on the lighting and everything that's going on and how subtle I want that fill flash to be, I'll set it to -2/3. So when you're doing the EV for the flash, when you're doing exposure compensation for the flash, you want to go to the negative end almost every time. I can't think of an instance where I would want it to go hotter. Now, if you do that, -1/3 or -2/3, you're going to get a very nicely rendered image, so much so that most people won't be able to tell that you used a fill flash on the shot. They're just going to look at the shot and go, oh, isn't that pretty? Now, the other thing that I've done on the X100V is I have the flash control set up on a function button, and I'm just using the function button in the front there. So when I want to use fill flash, I can do it quickly because I have the flash off almost all the time unless I'm in one of these situations. So I have it on the front button. I just press the front button and it turns on the flash. And then while I'm there, if I want, I can do additional settings. I usually just leave it at -1/3 and call it a day. Now, I encourage you, if you haven't played with this much, to do a before and after. I'm running a before and after in the show notes on the site, so you can go look at mine. And so one shot has regular fill flash with the X100V, and the other shot is just natural lighting. And you will see that it's just more flattering for the subject. The overall picture is more vibrant, it's more colorful. It just looks prettier using that fill flash. And I have it set up so that it's easy to do. You know, you just press that one button on the front, set it up, take it, and then when I go back to landscape photography or something else, I turn it back off. And that's the thing. You do want to turn it back off when you're not, you know, needing fill flash. If your subject is 30 feet away, it doesn't make any difference having the flash on or flash off. You're just using extra battery power, right? So that's another thing that's useful, is sort of understanding the range, you know, how much reach does the flash in your camera have, so you know at certain ISOs how close you have to stand. Like if you're at ISO 160, for example, then the reach of that fill flash is going to be less, right? It's only going to go, let's say, on your camera 8 feet or something like that, 6 feet. Whereas if you're at ISO 400, it's going to go further. It's going to reach maybe to 10 feet or something like that, where you get that noticeable fill-in capability. Fill flash is just this wonderful technique. I feel like because, you know, raw files and because highlight and shadow recovery and all that stuff has become, you know, so prevalent in our photography, because there's this wonderful portrait mode on our smartphones, all these reasons, it's sort of become lost in the fray. But the thing about it, and especially if you experiment a bit with your camera and really get to know how your camera does fill flash, it's a wonderful additional technique. And the images do look different than portrait mode on your smartphone. They do look different than recovering highlights and shadows with a RAW file. And the thing is, they come out of the camera looking good. So you have virtually no image editing to do. It's a great technique. Give it a try. And if you want to comment about it, or if you have some additional tips, I'm posting this article on the Facebook page, on our TDS Facebook page, where you can comment on it. Fill flash. It's a forgotten technique that, if you remember it, believe me, your candid outdoor portraits will look better than almost everyone else's. Tokina announces a new 500mm f8 reflex telephoto lens for six APS-C full-frame camera systems. And you can read the entire article on DP Review. In part, I'm talking about this today because I think this is kind of a neat lens. I like these types of lenses. And in part also because I think DP Review got it wrong before. And, you know, some wrong information, such as how much it was going to cost, which they said $250. I think they also said it was a 400mm instead of a 500mm. So I just want to make sure that if you heard any of that stuff, that you have the more current information, which also happens to be the more correct information. Let me read you this right now. Tokina has announced its new SZ Super Tele 500mm f8 reflex manual focus lens, a new super telephoto reflex that will work with six different full-frame and APS-C camera systems using the T-mount adapter system. And the T-mount means, by way of side note, that the mount itself on the lens is just like a screw threads, and then you get a T-mount that adapts those screw threads to the bayonet mount of your particular camera, and the lens will work on all of them. The fully manual lens is constructed of seven elements and seven groups, uses a 72mm front filter thread, has a fixed f8 aperture, and a minimum focusing distance of 1.7 meters, 5.7 feet. As with other reflex telephoto lenses, Tokina has included a T-mount system that will pair with adapters for various full-frame and APS-C camera mounts. At launch, the lens will have mount options for Canon EF, Fujifilm X, Micro Four Thirds, Nikon F, Nikon Z, and Sony E-mount camera systems. As with all reflex lenses, you can expect the donut-shaped bokeh from the 500mm f8 lens. Now, no pricing information for this lens has been announced at this time, but generally speaking, these types of lenses are very affordable, they're fairly light, and they're kind of fun. And if you don't do a lot of super telephoto work, but every now and then you need that extra reach, these lenses can deliver very good results for a very reasonable price. And you put this 500mm on, let's say, a Micro Four Thirds camera, you have a 1,000mm f8 lens, and you have some assistance with the built-in image stabilization. Although, when you're shooting at 1,000mm, I would probably want to use at least a monopod to make sure you get the sharpest results possible. And at f8, in bright light, you're not going to have much of a problem. But remember, you want to keep that shutter speed. For instance, on a Micro Four Thirds camera, you want to keep that shutter speed at 1/500th of a second or faster, even with the image stabilization, just to make sure that you get the sharpest image possible. A lot of times people complain that super telephoto lenses aren't very sharp. Actually, when used properly, they normally are very sharp. It's just that they're not used properly. People try to handhold them at these extreme focal lengths, and the magnification is just too great, even sometimes for image stabilization systems that are built into the camera. And camera shake is what you're seeing, not a flaw in the lens itself. Anyway, this is kind of a fun lens, and this is the latest. We should hear about delivery dates and prices and all that stuff pretty soon. But my prediction is that it's going to be an excellent value. It's going to be a good lens, and it's a sharp-looking lens. I've seen a prototype for it, and I think it looks pretty neat. Kind of one to keep on your radar for occasional super telephoto use. I have a few notes on our 2022 TDS workshop season. So I floated the idea by our Inner Circle group of substituting the Writing for Online Publishing workshop, which I have currently scheduled for March, with an instant photography hybrid class that does both instant and digital photography. And I show them the camera I was thinking about using for the class, and gave them more detail than I talked about last week. And although many folks that commented, and many Inner Circle members really helped me out with this, even though they were personally interested in this topic, they said that I just don't think that I would take a workshop in it. I just right now, if I'm going to spend any money at all, it's going to be on this lens or it's going to be on that camera body. And I feel like that this is a bit of a detour from the work that I'm doing right now. This is the gist of what most folks were saying. Therefore, as I kind of reviewed all of the comments, and again, thank you so much, Inner Circle members, for helping us out with this, I decided that, yes, they're correct. It's probably not a good idea for a workshop. However, I personally am going to keep playing with it because for my work, I really like this look. I love all the things that this Fujifilm hybrid camera can do. I like the different film simulations and the different effects, and then being able to print out right on the spot, and then also having a digital file at the same time, and then the things that I can do with all of that. So I decided that I'm not going to substitute out that workshop for the writing workshop in March. That being said, while all the other workshops are trending pretty well, our physical workshops, we continue to add signups every week for that. Our online workshops are looking pretty good throughout the season. The writing workshop that's coming up here in March is not trending well right now. We had a really good one in December. Maybe it's just too early to do another one, or maybe there's just not that many folks in this audience who are interested in the writing side of, online work. The photography, yes, the writing that goes with it, not so much. So I'm going to give it another week or so before I decide what to do with that writing workshop in March. If you want to sign up for this workshop, if you're thinking about it and you just, haven't done it yet, please send me an email and let me know that if I keep the workshop, you're interested and you want to sign up. Because if not, I don't want to cancel this workshop when people are out there were interested. They just, said, well, I can sign up any old time. So I don't want to pull the rug out from anyone. But at the same time, if I don't have enough people, and I need at least 4 or 5 people to make this workshop, worth doing, if I don't have those people, then I am going to go ahead and cancel it in March. Because guess what? In April, I have the Humboldt Redwoods, which we got a great group for that. There's still a few open seats for that, by the way, and I'm working with the Redwood River Walk-In, and all that planning is going great, and I can't wait to get out there. So I had that coming in April anyway. I have an infrared photography online event in May, and then in August, we're going to come back to black and white. In September, we're going up to the Eastern Sierra for a physical workshop in the Eastern Sierra. That's going to be fabulous. In November, we're going to Oregon Coast. So if you are thinking that you want to sign up for the writing workshop, you need to let me know. And I'm going to give it, like I said, another week or so, and then I'll make a final decision on it. And thank you, Inner Circle members, for helping us navigate these waters. Digital camera scanning is the best way to digitize film. This is an article that was on F-Stoppers, and I have a link to it. And it's actually a really nice video, but I'm going to read you a little bit about it. For film photographers, digitizing film is arguably the most important part of the workflow. For me, there is no longer debate on which is the best approach. Using a digital camera to digitize film is the only way. And this is brought to you by Kyle McDougall, whom I know. I've actually met him. He bought one of my cameras in the film camera shop. Actually, he's bought two of my cameras in the film camera shop. This video goes through Kyle's process and experience of digitizing film using a digital camera. More specifically, he is using his Fujifilm X-T4 equipped with a Seven Artisans photoelectric 60mm f/2.8 macro Mark II. And then the film is secured by a film advancer in holders. So he's using, you know, the gear is in the video. So you can see all the gear if you want the particulars. The article goes on to say, in this day and age, when the overwhelming majority of photographs live exclusively on our phones and occasionally make it into social media, and even more select few get printed, digitizing film has never been more important. That said, the actuality of digitizing process can be a real pain. The gear and process can easily get more expensive and time-consuming than any other part of your photography. So, and then he goes on and talking about, okay, I used to use this, and I used to use that. But what Kyle says, and believe me, Kyle McDougall is a great photographer. He's pretty well known. You ought to follow him on Instagram. You can see a lot of his work on Instagram. Again, shot with film and then digitized using this method. And if you want to learn on how he digitizes his film, and this doesn't have to be just for what you may be shooting right now, but if you have an archive of stuff and you've pulled out some images that you really like, you go, man, I love these 24 shots, then you might want to take a look at his video to see how to get the most out of those film shots when you digitize them. Terrific little video, great guy, and very helpful information. All right, let's take care of a little Virtual Camera Club news. Again, huge thanks to our Inner Circle members. Not only do they support this community month in and month out, but they also give us lots of advice and help us stay on track so that we're offering events and services and products and things like that that will be of greatest interest to our community. They represent our community, and they do so very well, I must tell you. They do so very well. You know, one of the things about my personality is that I'm interested in a lot of stuff, and sometimes I want to do this, and sometimes I want to do that, and do this, and do that. And they help me say, okay, that's great. Go ahead and explore all of that. But generally speaking, what we want to do is more like this, this, and this. And that's very helpful. So I'm not, you know, spending the time and money to offer you guys things that you might not be interested in or don't want to partake of. Inner Circle members have their own spot. They have their own website. You can get to it by clicking the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of The Digital Story. Go over there and take a look, and hopefully you will join us in 2022. If you have some film photography gear stashed away in the closet, under the bed, in the garage, that isn't getting used at all, and you want to get it in the hands of an analog photographer or a budding artist who will use it, who will love it, and who will make great pictures with it, let me know. Let me know. Go to thenimblephotographer.com, click on contact form, tell me what you have, and if you're interested in making a donation that helps support this site and it helps me get these analog cameras out of closets and out of under the bed shoe boxes and into the hands of people who will take pictures with them and who knows, could be the next great artist that we read about on one of our online sites. And for those of you who have donated gear recently, thank you so much for supporting this community and for supporting the world of analog photography. And finally, I'd like to give a big shout out to our friends at Red River Paper. These are the folks that know just about everything there is to know about inkjet printing, especially for people like us, photography enthusiasts that want to get our images off SD cards and off of hard drives and onto paper so that we can share them with the world in a very visceral way, in a way that where people can hold their images and look at them and see how the light bounces off the paper and really appreciate the shot on something, you know, on a sheet of paper that's far bigger than our iPhone screen or our tablet screen, and that holds up much better than when projected on a wall. Red River Paper has everything that you need, a variety of printing stocks, ink, accessories, envelopes, glassine sleeves, all the good stuff. And then there's a lot of information on the site to help you get the most out of your inkjet printer and do the kind of projects that you're interested in doing. They're the longest running sponsor of The Digital Story, and they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And big thanks to them for supporting this community. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Phil Flash is where it's at. Give it a try and see what you think. I'm working on more stories for next week. Until then, be creative. Stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.